or yet, so I'd have a hard time getting everyone in one night on foot or on my bike. It probably made a lot more horse sense to only dynamite or kill one person per night. I had a mission. It felt wonderful. Late one night after school, I rode my bike over to the Army-Navy Academy. I'd learned that most of our school faculty lived within a few blocks of our campus. Having written Moses' address and phone number on a piece of paper, I was able to find his home. I rode past his house several times. On my last pass, I saw a woman through the kitchen window, and I realized that she was our school librarian. I liked her. She was a nice person. I couldn't figure out why she would be at Moses' house. I pedaled home. That week, I asked some questions at school and found out that Captain Moses was married to our librarian and that they had a little girl. This pissed me off. Now I couldn't just blow up Moses' home because I didn't want to hurt our librarian and their child. I'd have to shoot Moses. Yes, I'd use my dad's old 30-30 Winchester and shoot him through their kitchen window. But I got to figuring and decided that a 30-30 was too big and noisy. Hell, I'd just use my 22 pump-action Winchester. After all, we killed our 1,000-pound steers with a 22. My secret life was so exciting. I was now shooting well over 500 rounds of ammunition per week. I was getting 10 or 12 rabbits every time I went hunting. All that training that I received from Shep on how to stalk game was now really paying off. One night, I decided to bike past the playground teacher's house. But I didn't take the piece of paper on which I'd written down her phone number and address. No, after that first night that I'd biked past Moses' house, I destroyed the piece of paper on which I'd written down his phone number and address. Hell, if a cop had stopped me and asked me what I was doing, and then searched me and found that piece of paper, my goose would have been cooked. Because once they'd begin questioning me, I was sure that I would have broke down and started crying and told them everything. Over and over, my dad had explained to me that a man had to keep his cards close to his chest, have a plan, think ahead, and always bring into consideration all the things that could go wrong, that a chain was only as strong as its weakest link. If I planned to kill all these teachers and that priest and nun who'd been cruel to me, I had to be the strongest, best-thought-out hunter-stalker I could be. Her house was easy to find. It was just off Wisconsin, two streets east of the railroad tracks. On my last pass by her house that night, I spotted her. She was coming up from the beach with her dog. Her dog immediately reacted to me. I guess that he could smell the hate I had for her, because he started not just barking, but going crazy. She never recognized me, and this was good. I decided that I wouldn't come back by her place until I was ready to do her in. And about her dog, what the hell? I'd just send him to damnation too when I blew up her house. The school year was almost over. Soon it would be summertime. I decided not to do all of my killings this year. What the hell, if I got caught, it could ruin my summer. And this summer I'd be getting that 22 Smith & Wesson revolver with the 6-inch barrel on a 38 frame that my dad had promised me. So I didn't want to miss my chance of getting this handgun and getting even better with weapons. Also, I was now preoccupied with a few other things, like this one great big older guy who rode on the bus with us every day. His name was Workson. He lived in North Oceanside. He was a day student like me, a sophomore in high school, a basketball player, well over 6 feet, and he wore a ring with a wolf's head with tiny red eyes. Every day when we'd pick him up in the bus that took all of us day students to school, he'd start off his day by turning his ring around on his finger and walk down the aisle hitting all of us younger kids on the head, telling us that he couldn't wait until we'd gotten out of grammar school and were in high school so that he could really give us our proper initiation, just as it had been done to him. One day he'd hit me so hard that I'd started crying. He'd called me a little sissy girl and hit me 6 or 7 more times, telling me that wolves came in packs, just like a platoon, and that I had to stop being a crybaby and grow up if I wanted to make it in high school at the Army-Navy Academy. He didn't know it, but that day he made it to my kill list. After that, his daily blows to my head, which he called knockers, didn't hurt as much, even though many times my scalp would be bleeding by the time we'd get to school. The little ears on the wolf's head were pointed and would cut into my head like sharp little spikes. Our bus driver saw this every day, but he only laughed, along with all the other older cadets, saying boys will be boys, just as Hans had done that night I'd had my encounter with the huge, monstrous frog. When that first year at the academy was over, my dad took me down to Johnson's Sporting Goods store in downtown Oceanside, and Mr. Johnson immediately brought out the .22 Smith & Wesson that my dad had promised to buy me. My God, the feel, the balance of this handgun was magic. This was no Saturday night special. This was a finely made weapon of utmost precision. Instantly, I became a great shot. Then I got a holster and ammo belt, just like in the good old Wild West, and I'd practice quick drawing and shooting. By the end of that long, hot summer, I was lightning fast and accurate, too. I decided that I wanted to kill Moses face to face, like in the old West at high noon on Main Street, Carlsbad. I wasn't just going to blow his house to smithereens. No, I wanted him to see my eyes as I came walking down Main Street, and I'd explain to him why he was going to die. "You're a bad teacher," I'd say, farting. "A cruel teacher who likes teaching meanness to kids. This is why you're going to die." I'd fast draw and gut shoot him first, then I'd shoot each leg and keep him alive so he could suffer and really understand why he was dying. I drew and shot well over 5,000 rounds that long summer, pretending that I was killing Moses with every wonderful, well-placed round. No longer did I hear the humming or purring behind my ears, but who cared? Now I heard the ringing of gunfire in my ears. And this felt almighty good. It was my second year at the academy, and a bunch of my fellow eighth graders were weightlifting behind a cottage on the grass. Only a few could standing press, without jerking, 100 pounds over their head. Walrick, Altamar, and a few others did 120 over their head. These guys were really strong. They told me to give it a try. I couldn't even budge the 100. They all laughed and said that I had better work out real hard this year, because things were really going to get tough for all of us once we got into high school with the big guys. These words hit me like a ton of bricks. They were right. I could see it so clearly. It wasn't enough that I was good with guns. I had to get physically strong like I'd been in third grade, before I hadn't been allowed to play at recess with the other kids. I began to put more effort into the push-ups and other exercises they had us do. A new teacher came to school. He was tall and had a loose hip gait like a Tennessee Walker horse when he walked. He kind of reminded me of the substitute teacher that I'd had the year before. This teacher's name was Brookhart. It was a beautiful name, I thought, a heart alongside of a brook. At the end of the year, he gave me a B by accident. I went to him and told him that I needed to talk to him privately. He said to meet him after school. I did. "Sir," I said. He was a captain like Moses. "You made a mistake on my grade."
"You think so?"
"Yes," I said. "I checked all my past homework real carefully, and I was supposed to get a D, not a B."
"You mean you're complaining because I gave you a B instead of a D?"
I closed my eyes in concentration. "No, sir, I'm not complaining. What I'm trying to do is get this straight so you won't get in trouble." He stared at me.
"You're concerned about my welfare?" I didn't know what the word welfare meant, so I shrugged.
"I don't know about that," I said. "All I know is that I like you, respect you, and so..."
I almost started crying, but didn't. And for the first time in years, I felt that humming start behind my left ear. Then I felt it shoot across the back of my head to my right ear. Instantly, I just knew that Papito Dios was here with me once again, massaging me.
"Look," he said, "I'm not going to get in trouble.
No one checks my grading, especially when they're B's or A's. Why not? I said, before I realized that I'd even spoken. Quickly, I cringed and ducked my head in case he took a swing at me. If there was one thing that I'd learned real well in school so far was not to question without being ready to get slapped or yelled at. But he didn't take a swing at me. Instead, he sat back on the front of his desk, just as Mr. Swift had done for those 3 days, and he looked at me with a kindness that I rarely saw in teachers, but I did see more in dogs, cats, horses, goats, and sometimes even in cows and pigs, too. "Because A's and B's are what the administration and the parents want," he said. "But don't they want to know if it's true?" He laughed. "No, not really." Then out of the blue, he said, "Look, I know that Moses has something going with you, but I want you to realize that it really has nothing to do with you. You see, he never got above a corporal in the regular army, just like Hitler, and so they both have that same kind of small man's mentality." I stared at him in utter shock. I didn't know that anyone knew about Moses torturing me every chance he got. "You don't really understand what I'm saying, do you?"
"No, not quite, sir."
"Well, that's okay. Just remember that you probably don't even belong in this school. This school is populated mostly with spoiled rich kids who weren't handled very well at home. You have a real home, from what I've heard. The B remains. And don't take Moses too seriously. The man is pitiful." I didn't know what this word pitiful meant either, but it felt so good that I was going to be able to keep the B and he wasn't going to get in trouble. And yet, I hadn't earned the grade.
"Yes, what else is it?"
"Sir, I didn't earn that B."
"Oh, yes, you did," he quickly said. "You earned it by having the honor of coming in and telling the truth, and that's rare."
"All right, enough. If you stay any longer, I'll make it an A." I left as quickly as I could, feeling 10 feet tall. Later, just before school was let out for the summer, I found that Captain Brookhart had actually been a major, or maybe even a colonel, in the real army, but they'd asked him to go down in rank so it wouldn't embarrass all the rest of the school staff, especially the colonel who ran the whole school, but had never even been in the U.S. Army at all. I came to realize that most of our faculty had fake rank, fake titles. My whole world went into a spin. I wondered if this was also true of the nuns and priests and teachers in public school. Were they really trained, qualified teachers who knew what they were doing? Maybe they weren't, and this was why they'd been so mean and ignorant about the whole educational system. The truth was that they really didn't even want to educate us. They wanted to train us. That was why they felt that they needed to break us down first, get rid of our spirit, our guts, our soul, so that they could then remake us in their own image of being mean, scared, and all mixed up. Boy, was I ever glad that I'd been too stupid to learn how to read. This was probably why I hadn't been able to get trained into all of their caca. No, I wasn't very smart, this I knew. But I was beginning to think that maybe, just maybe, I was some kind of crazy loco genius, burro genius. I mean, to have been able to hold on to my spirit for this long had to mean something.
Chapter 21. That summer, I drove out with my dad to look at a great big ranch in the San Luis Rey Valley. Part of the ranch ran alongside the little airport that was located just south of the main riverbed. It was a beautiful place, full of hills and valleys, and wild deer and quail and skunk and bobcat and even mountain lion. Its northern border butted up against Camp Pendleton for about a mile. My father asked me what I thought about it. I told him that I loved it. He said he loved it too. In fact, it reminded him a little of his home back in Los Altos de Jalisco. So he purchased the huge spread, and I learned how to drive a Caterpillar tractor, plant hundreds of acres of hay, and then bale it. I worked from sunup to sundown with our workers from Mexico.
I worked so hard that all night long I dreamed of baling hay, loading trucks, then unloading them into our barns. I didn't have a driver's license, but still I was driving trucks and tractors. This was the summer that I met John Folting, Terry Watson, and Ted Borland, Little Richard, Bill Coe, and Eddie O'Neill. I didn't see as much of Nick Rorick anymore. All these other guys lived in South Oceanside. They became my first real group of friends, next to Nick Rorick and Jimmy Tucker and Jimmy's cousin Michael. On my first day back on the school bus to the academy, I quickly got out of my seat the moment Workson, the guy who'd been hitting me on the head for 2 years with his wolf ring, got on the bus. "I'm ready," I said to him. "Ready for what?" he said, looking surprised. He was still a whole head taller than me, but I didn't give a shit. This was it. "You've been telling me for 2 years how you're going to really get me once I get into high school. So here I am. I'm in high school now. So come on. I'm ready. Try and get me." My heart was pounding a million miles an hour, but I knew what I was going to do. I had a plan. I was short, he was tall, so I was going to belt him in the balls again and again till he bent over. Then I'd grab him by the hair, jerk him down to me, and bite him on his long nose, tearing it off his face like I'd seen an old-timer bite the balls off of our goats and sheep. But what Workson did next took me by complete surprise. He started laughing. This I hadn't been prepared for. "Get away from me," he said, backing away. "You're crazy." My heart was beat, beat, beating. I screamed. I bellowed. I started kicking at the seats in our bus. Our bus driver pulled over. But this time our driver wasn't laughing and saying that boys will be boys. He wanted to know what was going on. I couldn't talk. I couldn't explain. Finally, Workson said that nothing was going on, that I was just a mixed-up little freshman who didn't know how to take a joke. My rage exploded. "It was no joke for my head to get bloody every morning for 2 years," I screamed. The driver told me to calm down and get hold of myself, or he'd report me. "Report me," I yelled. "This is all ass backwards. Where was your concern all these years when he'd hit us little kids? I'll report your ass too," I screamed. "Okay, there will be no reporting," said our driver. He was scared. I could see it in his eyes. It had worked. My surprise attack had paid off. "Please, just take a seat. You've made your point." I took a seat, sitting down, and tears of rage, not fear, began streaming down my face. I had my .22 Smith & Wesson revolver with me in my book bag. I would have belted him, bit him, shot him, and killed him. But he'd laughed and backed away, chickening out on me, and so he'd slipped out of my death trap. But at least I was now ready for Moses. Today, 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 I was going to kill him. This was why I'd brought my revolver, to kill Moses in public, face to face. Then a strange thing happened. That day after classes, a bunch of cadets started lifting weights out on the grass behind a cottage once again. And these were the big high school cadets, really big guys. Still, most of these guys couldn't press a full 100 pounds over their heads without dipping their knees a little bit, then throwing the weight upward. But a lot of guys could. They asked me to try. I said no, because I knew I couldn't even budge 100 pounds. But they kept insisting. So I finally agreed and walked up to the weights, took a few breaths, bent over to grab the bar, expecting it to be so heavy that I couldn't lift it off the ground at all. But to my utter shock, the bar and weights went flying up and over my head with ease. They added more weight. And it ended up that I could do 130 pounds in an overhead press without dipping my knees at all. My God, I was only a freshman, and already I was one of the strongest guys in high school. One cadet told me that maybe I should try out for the wrestling team. I'd never even known that our school had a wrestling team, but I'd always loved wrestling, so I immediately went to sign up. At the office, I was told by a senior who was already on the wrestling team that they were all filled up. I didn't understand. He explained to me that they wrestled by weights, and that each weight class was already taken by an experienced wrestler, so I wouldn't have a chance of making the team. I said I understood, but still I wanted to work out anyway, that it really didn't matter to me if I made the team or not. Still, he didn't want me, and said that maybe I was strong, as he'd heard I was, but I was too heavy to move with any kind of speed. I wondered if he didn't want me on the team because I was Mexican, or did he really think this? Hell, he didn't know me. I'd been wrestling calves and goats and pigs all my life. I was lightning fast. "I still want to work out with you guys," I said. "Okay," he said. "We could use extra meat to practice with." My heart exploded. He hadn't been very smart to say this to me. Now I was determined to bust his ass. "Come on, give it to me, God," I could hear my dad saying that his mother used to say when the going got tough. "This is our chance to move mountains." Within a week, I beat that guy who'd called me extra meat and had been on the wrestling team for a couple of years. I started running and running, lost 15 pounds, made the varsity team, not the junior varsity, and won 9 out of 12 matches against juniors and seniors, and I was a freshman. I forgot all about killing Moses with all this energy and time that I was putting out towards wrestling. I loved wrestling, and I also made some new friends. Juan Limberopoulos from Guadalajara, Mexico, Mick McLean's from North Hollywood, Hawkins, our team captain from Reno, and Fred Gunther from Temecula, just east of us. Our coaches were two Marines from Camp Pendleton, and these guys were fantastic. One almost made it to the Olympic Games. Our sense of balance, we were taught, came first. Then came speed, skill, endurance, and strength was last. I worked and worked with all my heart and soul, just as I'd done in the third grade with marbles, then with my rifles and pistol in the last few years. When the wrestling season was over, I was feeling pretty good about myself, until here came Moses, like right on schedule to make fun of me and get everyone else to laugh at me too. This day a cadet was found reading a Playboy magazine in class behind his textbook. Moses spotted this and took the magazine away from him. Then Moses showed everyone what the cadet had been looking at, a picture of a nude girl with huge breasts. Moses then went around the whole classroom asking each cadet what this picture represented for him. Many of us were so embarrassed that we didn't want to look at the girl or answer his question, but he kept insisting. And so some cadets finally said sex, while others said Marilyn Monroe. When he came to me, I just shook my head, saying nothing. But he got so mad at me that he finally shoved the magazine in my face. "What does this remind you of?" he demanded of me, pushing the nude picture into my eyes. "Or are you one of those others?" "Other what?" "Others," he'd said, rolling his eyes to the rest of the class. "Come on, speak up." "She reminds me of a cow who's had a calf," I finally said, seeing her huge ballooned breasts, "or a mother dog or pig who's just had a litter." The explosion of laughter that broke out from the whole classroom was devastating, and the loudest laugh of all came from Moses himself.
"He isn't even one of those others. He prefers pigs and dogs."
The laughter never stopped. Moses had just given my classmates an open license to ridicule me. And when they talked about Marilyn Monroe, I had no idea who they were talking about, and so they said that maybe I was one of those others. I got up and walked out of class. This was it. I was going to go home, get my gun, and come back and kill Moses. Moses shouted at me, telling me that I couldn't walk out of class. I laughed. Couldn't he get it? I'd already walked out of class, and now I was running down to the beach so I could run along the shore all the way to Cassidy Street, up the bluff, and get home. I was in excellent shape, so I knew that no one could catch me once I had a good head start. A lot of guys were faster than me at the academy, like Mick McLean's, who was on our wrestling team, but only a few had my endurance. I was going to go home to change my clothes, get my gun, put it in one of my school bags, then come back to the academy, find Moses, and walk right up to him and say, "Captain Moses, I need to show you something." Then I'd drop my bag, whip out my pistol, and gut shoot him a couple of times. Then, when he was down and bleeding, I'd explain to him why he and his type of bully mentality had to die. And no one would interfere with me because of the loaded gun in my hand. Also, a part of me didn't give a shit anymore if I was caught or not. I could now see that my objective wasn't just to kill Moses and all these other teachers who had abused us, but for everyone in all the whole world to know why. This wasn't going to be a surprise attack. This had to be a cold, premeditated act, completely well planned, just as it had been premeditated and well thought out to torture and beat us Mexican kids, starting in kindergarten, so we'd be a people, a gente, with our heads bowed down to authority forever, thinking we were inferior and worthless. I now realized that this was how you enslaved a people. You didn't just bring them over in chains from Africa. No, you convinced them that they were inferior, not evolved, subhuman. And then when you took off their shackles so they could go to work, you'd still have them enslaved and shackled inside of their minds for hundreds of years. And this system of teaching was fine with most Anglo teachers, because in the act of convincing us, los Mexicanos and the blacks, we were subhuman, they'd also convinced themselves that they were superior. Getting home, I was pouring with sweat, having run the whole way, which was about 4 miles. I tore off my uniform, got into my Levi's, boots, and Western shirt. I put on my Western hat, got my pistol and holster, and went up to the stables to do a little last-minute fast drawing and shooting. And man, was I ever lightning fast and accurate, too. Then, when I felt ready, I decided to go back home and get my hunting knife, which was razor sharp. This way I could cut Moses' guts out after I gut shot him so that no hospital could save his life. I wanted to make sure that he died a slow, painful death. After that, I'd drive over before the cops came and do in the playground teacher, and on her, I'd piss in her face as she squirmed in death and say, "No English, cabrona, Spanish only." Then, if I still hadn't gotten caught, I'd drive out to the San Luis Rey mission and get that priest who'd tortured me. I was now 16 years old, in perfect shape, and had arms of steel. I could do sets of 100 push-ups with both arms, or sets of 45 with either arm. And I was an experienced killer. For the last 2 hunting seasons, I'd gone with my father and the Thills to Meeker, Colorado to hunt mule deer. This last year I'd been so good with my new 30-06 Model 70 Winchester that I'd filled out the tags for almost everyone in our camp, because what most of these he-men hunters really liked to do was drink, play cards, and get away from their wives. 6 huge bucks I'd gotten this last year. I was a crack shot with rifle or pistol, and right now I was going to use a little .22 pistol to do in Moses. I'd use hollow point bullets and split their points in half with my knife for extra quick expansion in gut shooting him at close range. I was at our big gun cabinet getting my hunting knife and extra ammo when I heard my mother and dad in a big argument. This kind of screaming I hadn't heard for quite a while. I put my pistol, rifle, and knife down and went to see what the commotion was. My 2 sisters were in the bedroom with my parents, listening to the argument. "What's going on?" I asked Linda. "Dr. Hoskins is dying, and Papa wants Mama to go with him to see him." "But why?" I asked. My heart started beat, beat, beating. "He's the reason that our brother Joseph died," I said. My sister shrugged. "Yes, I know."
"Lupe, please," our father was saying. "It's been years since Chava Boy's death, and life goes on. We all need to know how to let go. Maybe you, but not for me. I still feel it cutting here inside of my heart. Joseph was only 16. He had his whole life ahead of him when this no-good drunk doctor..." "Lupe, Lupe, please," said our father. "The man is dying now, and that article in the paper must have cut his heart in two. We need to find compassion in our hearts and forgive him, Lupe." "No, never," screamed our mother. I hope he burns in hell!
The day before, our local newspaper had reported that Dr. Hoskins was caught drunk on the job at the hospital, and talk had it that dozens of people had died over the years because of his gross incompetence.
Lupe, said our father, this isn't just about forgiving him. It's also a way for us to bring all this anger out of our own bodies that we've been carrying in our hearts all these years. But how dare you say that to me, Salvador? All these years I've carried nothing but love in my heart for our dead son. Yes, but what have you carried for the living, huh?
Said my father. Then he added,
Tell me, Lupe, how can we expect God to forgive us if we can't forgive others? But I've never done such semejante pecado like this monster did to our son in all of my life. Maybe you, who've done so much wrong in your life, can find compassion, but not me, she screamed.
I was shocked. This was entirely not like my mother, who was usually so compassionate towards all people and soft-spoken, too. But I was also in total agreement with her. Our father closed his eyes in concentration.
Lupe, he said in a very slow, gentle voice, Jesus, who was free of sin, they say, he still found it in his corazón to forgive those who crucified him. To forgive, Lupe, isn't really for the other person. It is for helping us find peace in our own hearts.
I'm going up the hill to see Dr. Hoskins, and you can come with me if you'd like.
No, Salvador, screamed our mother. I forbid you to do this. This is criminal. He's going to get his just deserve at last. Let him now suffer as I've suffered all these years. May he burn in hell, is what I say.
I wholeheartedly agreed with my mother. Let the damn cards fall where they fell. Let the son of a bitch suffer, just like I was going to make Moses suffer when I now drove back to school and called him out. But my father obviously saw the whole situation very differently, and he now picked up his Stetson and, without saying another word, walked out the door. My sister Linda ran after him. She'd been following our dad around and trying to act like him for as long as I could remember. When she'd been 3 or 4, she'd ride her tricycle around the front fountain until our father would fall asleep. Then she'd take his cigar and smoke the gigantic thing just like he did as she rode around and around the fountain talking to the goldfish. I stayed behind with my mother and our little sister Teresita.
Damn your father, said our mother, crying. Why does he have to talk to me like that, trying to make me look like a bad person in front of you kids? Hoskins is finally getting his just deserves. Don't you see that, mijo? She said to me. I'm not a bad person. It's just that I can't forgive him in my heart. That would be false.
Yes, I said. I can see that, Mama. But, well, maybe Papa is right. We all need to learn how to let go. Joseph himself, I'm sure he wouldn't be happy to see you still mourning him after all these years. In fact, the last time I was with him, he told me that what was really needed here in the world wasn't more.
You just don't know what it is to be a mother!
My mother screamed at me, full of anger. Hearing this, I turned to go. This I'd heard too many times over the years.
Where are you going?
She asked. I kept walking.
I'm talking to you! She shouted.
I stopped and took a big breath. Mama, I said, turning back around to face her, I am not going to listen to you tell me one more time that I don't know what something feels like because I'm not a woman or I'm not a mother. My heart was pounding.
That's bully tactics. If you really think I can't feel that, then don't bring it up to me. Hell, sometimes I think that you just like all this suffering, so that then you don't have to go on with your own.
I stopped my words. Could this also be what I was doing? Using all my rage to avoid going on with my own life? I took a deep breath, said nothing more, and turned to go once again.
Where are you going?
I don't know, I said, maybe to go with Papa.
Mijito, please, don't do this. I beg you.
Mama, I love you, I said. But I also kind of, well, got to see what Papa is going to do with my own eyes. Because, well, maybe even I, myself, would be a lot better off to let go of all the anger I carry, Mama.
I was shocked at the clarity of the words that had just come out of my mouth. Hell, I'd never had these thoughts. Where had these words come from, and with such utter clarity? This was when I realized that that little quiet humming had started behind my left ear. It had been a long time since this had happened. I went out of the house, leaving my little sister, Teresita, with my mother. I felt sorry for Teresita. In no time at all, I was sure that my mother would have her crying and praying. I got my guns and knife, a bag of ammo, and went outside and got in my brand new turquoise-colored Chevy pickup that my dad had gotten for me for my 16th birthday and started down our long driveway. Getting to California Street, I stopped. I didn't know which way to go. Should I drive up the hill to see what my father was going to do? Or should I turn right, go down California Street, then take Hill Street south to the academy and kill Moses? I finally put my foot to the gas pedal of my Chevy, deciding to turn left, even though it was way easier for me to go kill Moses. Instead, I went up the hill to Dr. Hoskins's place. Moses would still be at the academy, I figured, after I was through seeing what my dad was up to. Then I'd kill him. Getting to Dr. Hoskins's place, I saw our big car parked to the left of his house over by the riding ring. Dr. Hoskins didn't ride Western. He rode English or jumping or some such stuff. I parked my turquoise-colored Chevy alongside my dad's navy blue Cadillac and got out. And there was my father and my sister Linda talking to Dr. Hoskins inside of the riding ring. They were talking quietly as people rode around them on horseback. I could hear that they were talking about saddles and bridles and the best way to keep the leather soft and clean. They were visiting like old friends, and I could see that the doctor looked so grateful that our dad had come to see him. They weren't saying a single word about my brother, and they weren't talking about the newspaper article either. Then when I came up close and my dad saw me, he introduced me to this man, whom all of my life I'd always known as the monster. Dr. Hoskins took off his riding glove and offered me his hand, and I could see that he was nothing but a tired old gentleman who looked very close to death himself. I hesitated. I glanced at my dad, and he nodded to me, but still, it was real hard for me to reach out and take the doctor's hand. After shaking his hand, I immediately backed away and watched my dad and this old doctor continue visiting. I flashed on what my brother had told me on the last day we'd been together. He'd told me what was needed on Earth wasn't control or more money or great new inventions. No, what the world really needed was so simple: patience, love, compassion, forgiveness, and understanding. Remembering this, I looked at my dad, and I could see that this was exactly what he was doing. And he wasn't faking it either. Mi papa was really, really forgiving this man inside of his heart as he spoke to him. I just couldn't, for the life of me, figure out how my dad was able to do this. Hell, I was ready to drive over to school as soon as we were through and kill Moses. I wanted revenge. I wanted justice after all these years, just like my mother. I wanted Moses to burn in hell for eternity. And yet, as I stood here and watched mi papa, a child of the Mexican Revolution, a man who'd gone to hell and back so many times in his life that he usually had more rage and vengeance in his heart than any 10 hombres, I could see that he was setting aside all this as he now spoke with the doctor. Then I saw it so clearly, why my dad was forgiving this man, just like Jesus forgave those men on the cross, because they hadn't known what they'd done. My heart began beating,
No, 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 I could never, never, never do this and live. I had to kill Moses and all those other people before I could live. But then it hit me. How in the world did I expect to live after I killed Moses and all those other people? The cops would come to get me, and no, I wouldn't kill them because I had no beef with the Oceanside police. In fact, three cops were close friends of ours, and I'd be arrested and taken to jail. And my parents would lose another son. Then both of their sons would be gone. So then, maybe killing wasn't the answer. Maybe there was another way to get the world to know about the abuses that had happened to me, and were still happening to so many Mexicanos. My heart was beating. Well, then, it could be, I said to myself, that my father was right when he'd told my mother, "Yes, you've been carrying love for Joseph, but what love have you been carrying for the living?" Because it was true. I could now see that our mother had been carrying her love mostly for the dead ever since my brother had died. And me? What was I doing? I breathed, and I breathed again, and continued to give witness to my dad, to mi papa, as he listened to all this doctor's small talk about bridles and saddles with such kindness, patience, compassion, and yes, forgiveness. And I could now see that this didn't make my father look weak. No, it was the opposite. It made him look so strong and healthy, 20 years younger than this doctor, and yet I bet that they were pretty close to the same age. My eyes started watering. I could now also see that this doctor was so grateful for this opportunity of forgiveness that it looked like he was going to leap out of his skin and hug and kiss our dad for having come to see him. I took another breath and wondered if I'd ever be able to do what my dad was doing, or would I forever be so angry here in my heart that I couldn't forgive just like my mother couldn't. I turned. I'd had enough. I said goodbye and went to my truck. I needed to go to the academy real quick and gut shoot Moses before I lost my nerve. After all, I was tough. I was a wrestler. I'd killed lots of game. I was no little scared coward anymore. But then I remembered that whatever I'd been through, my dad, mi papa, had been through 1,000 times more. And yet he was finding it in his heart to forgive this monster who'd killed his son. "Joseph," I now said as I drove down California Street and turned left on Hill to go over to Carlsbad to kill Moses. "Help me. I don't know what to do." And it had all been so clear to me before I saw our dad talking with Dr. Hoskins with such peace in his heart. Instantly, I felt that old purring behind my left ear. I'd asked for help, and here it was, humming, purring behind my left ear, and then traveling to my right ear. Then I heard that little voice inside of me, and it was telling me so clearly, without any confusion whatsoever, to turn right on Cassidy Street and drive down to the beach. I had no idea why I was doing this, but I trusted this little inner voice of mine, so I did as I was told and turned right on Cassidy. I crossed over the railroad tracks heading for the beach. Then I was told to turn right on Pacific and go past Buccaneer Beach. I did as told. Then at the top of the first little hill just past Buccaneer, I knew that I was supposed to park and get out of my Chevy. I did, leaving my guns in the truck, crossed the street, and walked out on the bluff. And there before me, sticking out of the incoming surf, was that big black rock. I hadn't been down here in years. It was the lowest tide I'd ever seen. The rock was more visible than ever. Quickly, I ran down the bluff to the water's edge. Back then, there were only a few houses in this area. All of the beach houses were either south or north of here. I glanced around, saw no one, quickly stripped, and walked out into the surf. The water was cold and felt good. I walked out a ways, then dove under the first good-sized wave. I'd become a pretty good swimmer in the last couple of years. The water was delicious. I swam out to the big rock, but didn't get too close so that the waves wouldn't smash me up against it. This was when I first saw the fins. And they were coming right towards me. the dolphins, began wee-heeing to me, just like they'd done to Midnight Duke that day years ago. I rolled low, guttural sounds back to them, and they began chirping. I dissolved. Just like that, all my rage dissolved inside of me, and I started swimming out to them. They screeched with happiness. I screeched too. This was all a dream come true. They came close and began to play with me. I laughed. I was so happy. Big, big, big happy. We began to talk together like familia, to give song back and forth. I too was now helping Papito paint his garden of paraíso. I'd found my place. I was free. Afterword. About my reading problema, I didn't find out that I was dyslexic until about 1985, when my wife and I took our two boys to a reading specialist because they too were having reading difficulties. One of our sons tested slightly dyslexic, the other tested moderately. The test scoring went from 1 to 20, with 20 being the most severe. Both of our sons were in the 8 to 12 range. We were told that dyslexia was a catch-all phrase, and that some forms of dyslexia were hereditary. I decided to get tested too, but I figured that it wouldn't be a true test for me anymore because by now, at 45, I knew how to read pretty well. I took the tests. When the woman practitioner returned with my results, I could see that she was on the verge of crying. She told me that I was completely off her charts, that it was a miracle that I'd ever learned to read, write, or even listen, because I had both visual and audio dyslexia. I began to cry, too. Someone finally understood all the hell that I'd been through since a child when I'd first tried to understand language. And yet, in other forms of communications, like painting, sculpture, music, math, problem-solving, and chess, I'd been very good. In fact, in high school, once I learned how to play chess, I'd play lightning fast, intuitively seeing all these different possibilities at the same time, and I'd won well over 100 chess games without losing a single game. And that included beating some of our faculty members who thought that they were very good at chess. So then, what does this catch-all phrase dyslexia really mean? Is this what enabled me to feel that humming behind my ears? Was this what allowed me to sometimes see the whole world come alive in light and color? Could dyslexia be a gift? Could it be that we were all dyslexic back at one time, when we all recognized that the kingdom of God was within and we knew how to bring what was within out into the world? Then about 3 weeks ago, now in the year 2003, I received an email that I think has maybe given me a small part of the answer. The letters in each word were a little scrambled, but I could read it. It said, "According to research at an English university, it doesn't matter in what order the letters in a word are. The only important thing is that the first and last letter are in the right place. The rest can be a total mess, and you can still read it without a problem. This is because we do not read every letter by itself, but the word as a whole, and the brain figures it out anyway. Could it be we stifle our children's genius by languaging them too quickly away from their hearts and into the straight and narrow confines of linear thinking? For thousands of years, women have been told that they become too emotional if they get into their feelings, and men have been told that they are wimps if they get into theirs. And yet, could it be that only by getting out of our heads and into our hearts and souls can we access our intuitive genius, our spirit guide reconnecting us to our natural full 13th-century perception?" About English only. Let me tell you a little story that happened in Houston, Texas, just before I became a national best-selling author. I met this young woman at the University of Houston. She looked like she was part black, part white, and part American Indian. She was stunningly beautiful, with huge greenish eyes. She spoke Spanish. I asked her where she was from. She said Panama. I asked her how she liked the United States. She said she didn't, and that as soon as she graduated, she wanted to return to Panama. I asked why. She told me that she'd had a boyfriend for 4 years. And the other day he said, "I think I love you." So I dropped him as fast as I could. "My God," she added. "After 4 years, he was still thinking about our love. I can't stand to be around people who are always thinking so much." I laughed. I could see her point completely. Because in Spanish, you'd never say, "I think I love you," especially after 4 years. That would be an insult. You'd say, "I feel love for you so deeply that when I just think of you, I start to tremble and feel my heart flutter." Why? Because Spanish is a feeling-based language that comes first from the heart, just as English is a thinking-based language that comes first from the head. And Yaqui, Navajo, and the 57 dialects of Oaxacan are ever-changing languagings that come first from the soul, then go to the heart, and lastly to the brain. In one dialect of the Mayan languaging down in the southern tip of Mexico in the Yucatan, I was told that there are 26 ways to say love, just as in the Eskimo languaging, I've been told, there are 26 ways to say snow. And so when a married man or woman has an affair with some other person, there's actually a word for this kind of short little happy love, just as there is another word for the kind of long, harmonious, thorough love that brings the married couple back together without having feelings of being betrayed. In fact, betrayal in marriage isn't a concept that's even available within this Mayan dialect, because love, in all her great wild twists and turns, is forever growing, changing, deepening in the ongoing drumbeat of our eternal hearts and souls. So could it be that we live in a very small and limited world by only speaking one language? Could it be that only one of anything imprisons the mind, religiously, socially, and politically, and only one in language is the first sign of the end of any nation? And also, could it be that in the first part of their lives, kids can easily learn two and three languages at the same time, but orally, and with play and games and healing stories, thus expanding their mental capacity far beyond what we now call the norm and access genius? Could it be that being taught to read and write before children have had their fullness of dream and play and adventure stifles them for life? Could it be that the whole future of our country here in the U.S. of A. is dependent on how fast we can get out of the straight and narrow confines of English only, which had its place for a little while, and enter into a greater and more flexible global understanding of communications? Personally, I had to go 6 months without speaking as an adult before I was able to refine my inner voice to become a writer. And in that time, I came to many very interesting understandings. One being that maybe, just maybe, even Jesus himself deliberately didn't learn to read or write until he was well past 12 years old, and that everything that he knew of the Bible before that age had been read to him. Why? Because he hadn't wanted to clutter his mind and get his heart and soul bogged down with the details of linear thinking if he was going to accomplish his earthly work in such a short life. Believe you me, children truly are our latest messengers from God, as my grandmother used to tell me, and each is unique and wonderfully brilliant already. One more story. About 2 months after my talk in Long Beach, California at that Kate convention, I saw Moses coming out of the Carlsbad post office. Immediately I tried to walk around him so he wouldn't see me, but he turned and saw me. "Hey," he said, "aren't you the author?" A lot had been written about me after the Kate conference in most of the Southern California papers, plus the Bay Area of San Francisco. "Yes," I said, "I'm the writer." He smiled and looked at me like he was trying to place me. He looked old and weak, and certainly not as big as I remembered him. "I had you in class, didn't I?" he asked. I nodded. Yes, you did, sir. I thought so, he said. Then he said something that I'll never forget as long as I live. We had fun, didn't we? He asked. Hearing this, I almost shit a brick. I guess he had no memory of the torture that he'd put me through. I smiled. I laughed. Then did this mean that I was the only one who remembered all the crap that he'd done to me? I felt like belting him in the mouth. But how could I do this? He looked so old and weak and pitiful, just the way Brookhart had referred to him. Yes, I finally said. We had fun, sir. I thought so, he said, grinning. I began to grin, too. What else could I do? Your wife, I said. How is she? His face twisted. She died several years back, he said. Oh, I didn't know, I said. I always liked her. She was a very decent, good-hearted woman. His old wrinkled-up eyes filled with tears.
She was the best thing that ever happened to me.
I nodded. I bet you're right. Bye, I added.
Goodbye, he said. Good to see you,
he shouted after me.
Keep up the good work. We're all proud of you.
When I was done at the post office, I crossed the street, went into the restaurant bar across the street, and ordered a beer. To you, God, I said, making a toast. To you and your wild sense of humor. I drank my beer, then got on my bike and pedaled over to the beach. A part of me realized that I had to thank Moses, because it was a lot of my hate towards him that had kept me going all these years. Down at the beach, I pulled over and looked out at the sea. Past the surfers, the water was calm. There really weren't any good waves, not for surfing anyway. I breathed and became mesmerized by the quiet movement of the water as I looked out past the breakers to the huge expanse of ocean, our mother, the place from where all life originally came. I said a little prayer for Moses and his wife. Then it dawned on me that his name was just like Moses of the Bible. I'd never made the connection before, and it was so obvious I started laughing. Oh, my Lord God, there really was a larger, grander plan going on that we mortals couldn't see. Moses had done his job once again. It had been he who'd led me out of the desert and to the promised land within my own soul. That little purring began behind my left ear, traveling across the base of my head to my right ear. All around me, I began to see the whole world come to life with light and color. Once again, it was another gorgeous day in Paraíso. Thank you. Gracias. This concludes Burro Genius by Victor Villaseñor, narrated by Robert Fass, a member of SAG-AFTRA. Copyright 2004 by Victor Villaseñor. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Harper Perennial, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers, and was produced in the year 2019 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.